Hello, this is Jeff Salzenstein, and we've got another wonderful interview today. I brought on one of my good friends, mentor, someone who has certainly studied the game as much or not more than anyone else out there. Our caller today has a wonderful website called tennisplayer.net, and it's certainly the best resource out there when it comes to studying high-speed footage out of all the pro players are doing. And I just want to welcome John Yandell to the call. Thanks for calling in today, John.
Jeff, good to hear your voice.
Yeah. So I know you're vacationing right now. You're taking a nice little few-day rest, and I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule from your vacation to talk to all of us today. And we're going to get into the forehand, and it's a conversation that we've obviously spoken a lot about, not only when I played on the tour, when you helped me and we got some high-speed footage of my forehand, but certainly we've had several conversations over the last 10 years about this very unique stroke, and it's a stroke that many people are fascinated by. So I thought that we could pick your brain a little bit, if that's all right. Wanted to get in and talk a little bit about maybe just your overall philosophy on what you've learned from studying all of these wonderful players over the years, and also your experience, obviously, as a recreational player and working with recreational players and high school junior players. Just kind of give me your overall viewpoint of the forehand and where you're at with it today.
Well, I think that it's probably even more complex to understand than the serve. The service motion may be more involved, but the thing that makes the forehand different is the movement and the fact that you are reacting and striking an oncoming ball, and each and every one of those oncoming balls is a little bit different. No two forehands are exactly alike. So I think, you know, one of the big issues now, everyone likes to study the pro game. Everyone likes to talk about the pro game. Everyone likes to try to apply the pro game to their game. But the question is, you know, A, what are they really seeing? And B, to, you know, what extent does it apply? And there's no doubt that certain fundamental elements in the pro game are fabulous models for players at every level. And, you know, I think that's the greatest value is the power of that imagery. The problem is identifying what that is. For me, I think if you look at certain elements of the preparation, that's where most players can get the greatest benefit. If you watch club tennis, it can be really depressing because you see people standing on their side of the net and the ball bounces and they're in the ready position. And if you watch it pro players, what you see is there's an immediate recognition of the ball and an immediate initiation of the preparation. And this is actually easy. You know, the key moves are body, the stretch of the left, the body, so that it's big. And this is how this player at any level gets the most natural body lift. That's fundamental. The other aspect that look at forward swing.
John, you're breaking a bit.
Hello? Hello?
Up a little bit.
I can't hear you either.
I'm here, yeah.
So you want to get point two? This one? Got all that stuff on the contact, on the preparation, you could chop it.
I think that rolling.
I'm on a landline, so.
Okay. Keep rolling.
Okay. So preparation is key, and that's something that all players can learn from the pros, how to turn the body, how to stretch the left arm, and to strive to reach that turn position at roughly the time the ball bounces on the court. That's key because most people don't prepare and they prepare late. And, you know, unfortunately, there are gurus out there who claim you should wait to prepare. That's some of the worst advice you could possibly receive when you see what most players are dealing with. The second key element that I think we can all learn from in the pros is the length of the forward swing. And by that, I mean when the top players, and it's the same for Nadal, Djokovic, Federer, any top player, when they're driving the ball, okay, the racket and the hand continue outward in the direction of the opponent for a substantial distance. And so there are many different finishes in the pro game. There's the over-the-shoulder, there's the wiper, there's the reverse finish, like Nadal coming over the head. And players tend to focus on that because it's so flashy and it's relatively easy to see. And what they miss is in the basic drive, which is what most club players are hitting or should be hitting on most of their balls, regardless of the finish, that hand is going to extend outward. It's coming around on an arc. There's no doubt about that. But if you were to freeze your motion when your left hand is about, I mean, your right hand, your racket hand is about even with your shoulder, you're going to see a couple of feet of spacing, regardless of what's going to happen next in the finish. So those are the two key points that I think we can all learn from the pro game.
So, John, listening to you, would it be safe to say that with a rec player that wants to transform their forehand, two big problems that you see is that they don't use their off arm or stretch their arm off arm across their body enough. It's not a strong enough position with that first move. And number two, they don't extend out enough and they pull off the ball, or they, I call it kind of alligator arms. Their arm is kind of bent and they just kind of come around instead of extending out. Would you say those are two major things that you see?
Time and time again, those are the fundamental problems.
So it's interesting because that was something that even with my forehand, when it would break down, I usually felt like I was too close to the ball or I was too jammed. And even when I see guys on the tour miss their forehands, they're usually not too far away from the ball. Usually when they're set up, they somehow get a little bit jammed, and I feel like that creating more space both at the first move and at the finish position is huge. So great points there. Let's talk a little bit about the kind of mysterious concept these days of the bent arm versus straight arm forehand. I get questions about it at my website. I see posts on Facebook and different tennis forums, and people are going back and forth about what the best method is. I've got my theory on it, but, you know, when we look at Federer and Nadal, two of the biggest forehands in the world of all time, they essentially have a straight arm when they're making contact or just prior or just after. And then you've got Djokovic and guys that have retired like Fernando Gonzalez and others that have bent arms and have massive forehands. What is your take on this concept, especially as it relates to grip styles or just the way a person is built? Where should a rec player go with this?
Well, I think it's very, very unusual. Non-existent to find someone playing, say, you know, at the 5-0 level or below that should be trying to develop a straight arm forearm. You know, I mean, the thing that is missed in people who look at the arm structures in the program. And by the way, I was the first one to come up with that terminology, bent arm, straight arm, double bend, you know, a straight elbow, from my study of high-speed footage. And people have really latched onto it. When Federer or Nadal or Djokovic hit forehands, two things are happening that don't apply in the recreational game, okay? That is, A, the contact height is usually far above where we see the ball in the recreational game. And so a large percentage of forehands at the pro level are hit in the air, right, with one or both feet in the air. And related to that is the body rotation, okay? Because the players are coming into the air or are detaching from a two-foot base, they're able to rotate the back or the hitting arm shoulder through substantially further, okay, than in the old days where, you know, you tried to keep both feet on the ground and step in, right? So if you're going to hit a straight arm forehand, that correlates usually with the extreme body rotation. And if you're not in the air, you can't really rotate the body. And at the lower levels, it's ridiculous to jump in the air when the ball's at waist level. So, you know, the other factor about the straight arm forearm is that the timing of it is more difficult because the contact point is further in front of the body. Now, if you look at the biomechanical research being done by people like Dr. Brian Gordon, it may actually be true that all other factors being perfect, that if you hit with a straight arm, you're activating the stretch-shortened cycle in your shoulder more completely and gaining racket head speed. I mean, you know, people fall for that line of reasoning when they don't have even close to the more fundamental elements you and I just talked about. So, you know, you got a guy who's recently been the number one player in the world, Djokovic. You've got Agassi and Sampras who have some of the best forehands ever. You know, it's obvious that a world-class forehand can be hit with a double bend. And there's no doubt in my mind that for the average player, the double bend hitting structure is going to combine the best with the actual other technical elements that they're developing in their forehand.
Yeah, and you know, when I teach it or I talk about it, I want players to be relaxed. And I think it's that level that you're talking about, the recreational level. Anyone trying to straighten their arm out is probably going to create more tension in their body rather than more relaxation. So finding that balance of getting good spacing but feeling that relaxed arm, that's what I look for, and usually that arm is bent at contact. Great point there. I got a really interesting thought as you were talking. I know you, twice a year, I believe, you go to two major tournaments to get your high-speed footage, stay on the cutting edge of what's going on out on the pro game. You go to Indian Wells and you go to Cincinnati, and the time of this interview, you know, we're ending the summer of 2013, and we're watching one of the most remarkable seasons of all time by a great champion in Rafa Nadal. You watched him in Indian Wells winning his first hardcore tournament of the year. You watched him in Cincinnati hit forehands and blister through that draw, and obviously you've probably been watching him on TV as well. Give us a sense of what's going on with his forehand, especially now. I mean, obviously he's always had a huge forehand, but could you feel a palpable difference sitting courtside, sitting, you know, on the court, taking footage of his forehand, the sound off the racket, the movement, the acceleration, the court positioning? Tell us what's going on from your perspective in watching him play those two events this year live.
Well, I mean, you know, the factor that you have to start with in any discussion of Rafa is that this guy is a beast, you know. He has a physicality that I think is superior slightly to anyone else right now. And there's an intimidation factor that goes with that. Despite his unfailing, politically correct and polite comments whenever interviewed, there's no doubt that this guy has the heart of a killer and, you know, would probably bite your finger off, you know, to win a point. And that's the way he plays. So, you know, the physicality is the first thing. I mean, ironically, you know, what you see from him applies probably less than ever at the lower levels, beyond, you know, the idea that, you know, physical intensity and 190% effort on every ball will go a long way. But if you look at his forehand, you know, the left-handedness of Nadal, whether natural or created, is just a massive advantage for him. So combined with everything else, you know, he is able to work his forehand in patterns and in ways that just really create misery for right-handed players. And if you look at how his forehand has evolved over the last couple of 3 years, he has two basic finishes, one where he wraps around his opposite shoulder, but more and more he does the reverse finish. You know, and that term was developed by Robert Lansdorf to describe a finish that eventually comes back to the side where the swing started. And this is something we haven't been able to determine from the high-speed footage because we would need to do multiple camera, three-dimensional shoots. But my belief, and I think it fits with just watching his ball, is that that finish allows him to hook the ball as well as make it jump. So you've got the guy that's seen more spin than, you know, anybody else in the game on average. That figure's been widely quoted. You know, we filmed forehands of his that were spinning close to 5,000 RPM, and he's averaging about 3,200 RPM, which is, you know, 20% more than the other top players. Just, you know, to get a sense of it, it takes about a second for the ball to get from his racket to the opponent's racket. That's a, you know, a good average length between the exchanges. In that second, his ball is turning over 50 or 60 times. So try to visualize that. And now not only the amount of hop, how high it comes up, but that it's hooking away from your backhand. So, you know,
that doesn't sound fun to me.
No, if you know, I'm like 5'11 and a half, and if I were to stand in my backhand corner on the baseline, some of those balls that he's hitting would be bouncing over my shoulder as well as hooking away from me. So
yeah, it's just,
you know,
a nightmare to deal with. Yep.
Yeah, he gives the feeling of being absolutely impenetrable and, you know, indefatigable. You can't tire him out, and you can't do anything with his ball. You know, just defending his ball is an exhausting, trying experience physically and mentally.
Well, I find a couple things I find interesting about where he's at right now is at the U.S. Open. You know, they talked about how he hadn't lost serve, I think, until he played Gasquet in the semis. And we're not talking a guy that's serving a buck 30 like Sampras. So he's obviously serving, picking his spots, but then once that point starts, he's completely dictating with that forehand wing more than anyone that maybe has ever played the game before. to be that dominant on that side and the way that he can get around the ball. The other concept that you mentioned that was something that I would love our listeners to pay attention to is you first talked about his physicality. And the second part that we didn't talk a lot about, but that's one adjustment he's made, is his court positioning. He's moved up into the court this past year more so than he has in the past. And just by moving up in the court a bit more, being more aggressive from the baseline on the hard courts, and then the fact that he is an absolute beast allows his forehand to be that much bigger. So all the listeners out there, you know, not only can you improve your technique with spacing and your finish, but if you improve your physical strength, you can actually hit the ball bigger.
Right. So, I mean, if you look at most club matches, a 6-4, 6-4 match is, you know, about 100 points. And the winner is going to win like 52 to 56 of those points. So the idea of striving and making the type of complete effort on every ball pays off in the mental struggle. Even if you lose a game, if you came back from 40 love to deuce and lost the game, you still took something out of the other guy in winning those 3 points. And if you're prepared to do that point after point, there's a cumulative effect. And I think this is one of the things that, you know, why Rafa defeats opponents before he walks on the court with him. I mean, you know, he's got arguably the greatest player of all time completely intimidated because the guy, you know, Federer just doesn't have ways to win points easily against him.
Yeah, very fascinating. And it'll be interesting to see how, not only how he finishes the year, but what he does in 2014. Well, John, always insightful information that you share with our listeners. Great stuff. I always learn a lot every time we get on the phone. Why don't you talk a little bit about your website and what's going on over there and any new stuff you have on the horizon for what you're doing at tennisplayer.net.
Well, we'll just continue to seek out the cutting edge information and bring to fore coaches that are, you know, very famous and coaches that are going to be famous. That's one component to it. And I'm sure all your followers have seen our fabulous Tennis Channel commercials, and they should know for the first time ever I've relented and I'm offering a free 30-day trial. So you can sign up there and at any point in the 30 days, if you decide, you know what, this isn't for me, I promise you I won't charge your credit card at the end of the month. And that's been phenomenal for us. So I would encourage anyone who is intrigued by Tennis Player to go ahead and check it out for free now.
And I agree with what you just said. My coaching would not be where it's at right now without the forward thinking that you have, John, and what you've done with that website. I remember starting out with those VHS tapes of Sampras and Querétin and Agassi, and before I even knew you, and that really got the wheels turning on how I could not only learn the game as a player but teach it as a coach. So everyone listening, check out his site, tennisplayer.net. Sign up for that free subscription because it's definitely worth the value for that first month to check out. And then after that, it's certainly worth the value of staying in there. So, John, thanks again for your time today, and we'll see you at the next interview.
A pleasure, as always, Mr. Salzenstein.
Talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye.